Hey, welcome to another episode of Stuck at Home. This is Om Malik, your host, talking to my dear friend Riley Kramer, who is founder and lead partner at Trucks.VC, which is a San Francisco-based early stage fund that invests in mobility and autonomous the trends. Is that right, Riley? Did I get that right?
Yeah, we focus on transportation, and it often means things with wheels, you know, whether it's moving people or goods. And we like to be very early. So, you know, before there's a product and before there's revenue, we'll back those founders.
You move before the market moves. That's out, right?
Hopefully. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
How are you doing, brother? It's I haven't talked to you in a few weeks, and I'll just bring me up to speed with yourself, your family. How are you dealing with this pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Om. I would say on a personal level, I'm still trying to find my center. You know, I have a 3.5-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter. And, you know, my son, who's 3.5, he got sick a week ago and he had a fever for a couple of days. And so, you know, 3.5-year-olds get sick a lot, but because of where we are right now in the cycle, everything is looked at under the microscope. So it was a pretty stressful 4 days, to be honest with you. And, you know, we had him home here. We didn't have him tested or anything like that. And by the 4th, 5th day, his fever broke and, you know, he didn't have any other symptoms. So I breathed a big sigh of relief. And, you know, chances are my kids will get sick, you know, during more periods of the shelter in place. So it's just one of those things that happens. But when you have kids, you kind of think more about it now in a different way. So that stress aside, you know, I'm trying to get normalized to kind of what it's like to be a competent work from home person, and trying to break up my day a little bit with family time and walks and other stuff. And then on the sort of on the fun side, you know, we're trying to figure out the best way to help our founders through this and triage the portfolio. And, you know, there's a bunch of stuff there that I'm doing for the first time, and, you know, trying to get through as best I can.
Well, at least you know, that we're dealing with a lot of uncertainty now. And, you know, I don't think this is a short-term thing. It looks like it might take a little while to work through the system. I mean, you know, you and I have talked in the past that, you know, there was some slowdown in the overall transportation, mobility, autonomous markets coming in 2020. So you think, how does that this pandemic-related, you know, slowdown impact those sectors?
Yeah. When it comes to autonomy, most people think of passenger vehicle autonomy, because certainly that's been the, you know, I would say majority of the way that people have thought about this is a robo-taxi. So, you know, the reality of robo-taxi is that they're very expensive. You know, if you look at the Cruise vehicle or, you know, the Zoox prototype, you know, the things that you need to do differently are a pretty big step from today's traditional vehicles. And as a result, most of the business models were around shared pooled rides, where you'd be in the, you know, effectively in an Uber pool kind of experience. And, you know, right now, I think all those shared use mobility models are getting put under the microscope for different reasons. So one of the interesting things about the AV teams, particularly the ones that are tied to an automaker, is that they'll probably create smaller vehicles. So it wouldn't surprise me if you saw Waymo, Cruise, Argo, all those kind of, you know, the top competitors that have been funded with billions of dollars. It wouldn't surprise me if you saw the form factor in those in the future getting actually to be a smaller single or maybe double occupancy vehicle, as opposed to the minivan shape or the one box shape that we've seen and gotten used to over the last year.
So you mean to say, like, you see another, like, shift in this market towards, like, very small vehicles and maybe even vehicles less for people and more for, I don't know, goods and stuff like that, mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of like, you know, vehicles driving themselves, dropping off things at certain locations. I mean, a more advanced version of the Postmates robot.
Yeah, it's interesting about the delivery piece, because I think that delivery robotics in the United States, at least, China's a little bit different market, but in the United States, there's been kind of two different flavors. There's the small delivery robots, which are typically going, you know, 2 miles an hour on the sidewalk, that actually don't exist in San Francisco because there's no sort of regulatory area for them legally. But in other cities, you know, the Postmates robot and Marble and Starship are examples. Those are, you know, because of the speed and the kind of space within those vehicles, they've mostly been for convenience items, you know, like hot food delivery and a pizza, maybe a one parcel, things like that. And then on the other end, there's like the larger vehicles. So you can think about whether it's an automated, you know, Nuro car, or there's a company that we invested in Ann Arbor called Fraction, which is a little bit smaller than a Nuro. Those are typically doing things like grocery delivery, where you can have multiple bags of groceries or essentials, really. And I think the interesting thing right now is that all the stuff that's in delivery robotics, that maybe people thought, oh, those are like a nice to have, those are probably going to be pulled forward, and there's a really interesting kind of demand for those models now. So if you look at what Nuro does, you know, they do grocery delivery for one of their partners is Kroger. And, you know, our company Refraction has seen some interesting inbound demand for some stuff that's not typically convenience items. So I think that although up until the beginning of this year, I thought that most of the investment and the focus has been on robotaxi, it had started to wane a little bit because so many of the big players had made their bets. I think that the interesting shift is to these, to the delivery robotics in these kind of medium format sizes, whether you're talking about grocery or something like that, where you can still travel at pretty good speeds, you know, 25 miles an hour. You can deliver your groceries or your essentials. And I do think there's probably a brighter future for that stuff. And it really aligns with some of the things we've seen over the last week or two, maybe, which is, you know, the U.S. delivery market has historically been focused around kind of on-demand stuff like getting your dinner, but increasingly it's about, you know, getting your groceries. And so those models, which are, you know, Instacart and Shipt and Walmart delivery or Walmart grocery, I think it's called, and Amazon Fresh, those are really about getting the essential stocked. And so what are the ways that we're going to see more people do that through this period and then after? I think that's kind of an interesting thing for us to chew on.
Do you think this accelerates that whole thing? I mean, more dollars go into it. It's becoming pretty obvious. Like there is so, you know, the societal, importance is becoming pretty obvious. There's a lot of people putting their life at risk by essentially being delivery people for other, you know, the haves, right? Like
right.
That makes, like, just for a lack of a better word, like, and it's kind of like not fair to a lot of people to take on so much risk, and they're doing it because that's the only way they can make a living right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's definitely like as we look at, you know, 15, 20 years out, and if, like, you know, climate change accelerates and the way all indications are towards rapid change, I mean, things become much harder outside. We got to have machines doing the job, which human beings may not be capable of handling, like, you know.
So, I agree. Yeah. I think, one of the things about some of these immediate changes in behavior, particularly related to grocery, if you look at the business models for a lot of these delivery services, you know, Shipt and Instacart, as a couple of examples, typically they make sense when you do a 12-month subscription to their delivery service. So Shipt, which is owned by Target, you know, you sign up for $99 for a 12-month period. And then every time you order, I think it's $35 or more in your cart, you get that delivered, quote unquote, for free. And so I think there's a couple kind of interesting things coming out of this. One is for the people right now who are using Shipt, and we, for example, we bought a subscription to that service for my wife's mother who lives in Michigan, who would normally just go to the local grocery store there, but we wanted to make sure she didn't do that. So now she's kind of used to doing Shipt, and you know, for the next 2 or 3 months, she'll be using it. And then after COVID-19, you know, shut in ends, I bet that there's a significant number of people who continue to use it because they've got the subscription for 12 months. And so I think there's an interesting tipping point around grocery and how it changes some of the things around delivery for all the other parts of life. Getting to the kind of the root of your question on the labor piece, you know, all the things right now that we define as essential to the American economy, to the world economy, but here in America with some of the things that we now kind of rely on as essential, whether we're talking about transportation, people running the buses, people doing grocery, people doing delivery, I think it really is the moment where you kind of have to reformat what are the support systems and what are the things in place so that if you define those acts as essential, you need to give those people the kind of support, whether it's healthcare, whether it's job security, where they know that the work they're doing is actually essential. Because right now, a lot of those systems are essential to the end user, but the framework for them to actually do their job for the gig workers is really, frankly, it's not good enough. So you've seen some strikes. You've seen some people walk out, seen a lot of the delivery windows and the services go away because they can't manage the capacity they have on their own side. And so this is going to throw a lot of change on the consumer side, but I think on the kind of like welfare side of how we treat those parts of the economy.
I mean, that, you know, that can, you know, that will take us into a whole different conversation about redefining capitalism and how we need to think about what it means, because it's like, I don't know, you have two kids at home and you have to homeschool them, probably reinforce the value of teachers to you in a more effective way in last right. 2 weeks than in last 2 years, right? Like, yeah. Oh my God, they're just more than teaching people. I mean, teaching your kids, they're doing a lot more. And I think it's in many ways, I think we have to reevaluate the value we put on essential services of all kind, whether it is teachers, whether it is fire people, firemen. You know, like, just look at the rank and file who's at risk right now. It's not people like you and I, you know, which is, and so we really have to rethink a whole lot of things right now. And that's how, I mean, the more I think about it, it's not like we have a choice. We have to.
Right.
I think this thing just only reinforced the inequality argument, right? Like, and it's thrown it in our faces. I hope people actually remember that and not go back to being who they were before the crisis hit. You know, I worry about our lack of being very capable humans.
I agree with you. I think that the definition of essential during a pandemic or a wartime is something that should carry in peacetime. And so, you know, anybody that was doing a job of a essential category today should have rights and should have support well coming out of this. And, you know, there's some interesting categories here. A lot of them, you know, relate to medicine, food, logistics. Frankly, they're categories that are really, you know, I think all of us kind of assumed that they were essential and pivotal, but now are kind of really a matter of life and death for a lot of people. And yeah. So no doubt, I'm with you 100%. On the education side, this is probably one of the interesting parts about San Francisco in general too, where we live is, you know, a lot of the people that perform the essential functions of the city right now, historically, and I would say in the last 10 years, have mostly been priced out of living in San Francisco. So, you know, you are going to have more and more of these kind of people who demand essential services, but the people performing the essential jobs actually aren't going to be close by. It's been the case in San Francisco for years with firemen and with teachers. And so that's going to be one of the fundamental sort of things that the country has to face coming out of this.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I was really thinking about, you know, I mean, we are going to spend $2 trillion to boost the economy, maybe another $1 trillion on some infrastructure front. But, you know, thinking about, like, the key thing which we need right now is healthcare and a more robust healthcare system, which is not biased against people who have, like, nothing. And that's not going to cost $3 trillion. And I think that's, unfortunately, the argument which is being lost on everyone, you know, all the time. Anyway, this is definitely a more philosophical conversation for you and I, hopefully after the lock-in or the shut-in ends, and we can grab a glass of wine and talk about it. But I also want to talk to you about the area of expertise for you, which is, you know, you're very close to transportation and mobility. That also means you're close to automobile sector. We've seen the rise of, you know, ride sharing and, you know, or, you know, car hailing, whatever you want to call it, Uber, Lyft, and the likes. And, you know, I mean, how long can this survive, this prolonged, you know, shutdown? In a sense, more than that, like, you know, I will have to think three times before I get into a stranger's car. I don't know how clean it is. I don't know who I'm getting in. Like, I mean, just like, you know, this virus is like taken away, you know, the basic level of societal trust that, you know, everything is okay-ish.
Right.
And like, you know, do companies like Uber and Lyft kind of survive this, or this behavior change, or this mistrust of the other?
Yeah, I think at a personal level with the drivers, you know, there are some things that we're not doing in the United States that, for example, in if you book a taxi in China right now, it actually says that you're required to wear a face mask while you're waiting for your ride. You actually get information about the driver, including if they've had a temperature check that day. And then there's a sign inside the taxi that says that the vehicle has been disinfected. So the amount of kind of, not only from a, like, technically doing things to make sure that the person is safe, the person is without symptoms, but also communicating that those things to the end user as a design decision. We are doing none of those right now. And the US and European based ride hailing networks are going to have to do that. I'm kind of fascinated by, and I was recently last week reading up on kind of the differences between, I just thought cleaning was a catch-all category. And I realized that there's a difference between cleaning, sanitizing, and disinfecting. And, you know, I've often thought that cleaning was really that's what you wanted. You know, you just kind of want there to be no visible debris and dirt, things like that. And I think that was kind of good enough for many of these categories, whether you're talking about shared use in a UberX ride or sitting in an NBA arena or something like that. That was kind of good enough. And going forward, there's going to be some other design requirements. One of them might be sanitizing, might be disinfecting, but also might be communicating to the user that it was done recently. You know, I think about things like if you've had pharmaceuticals delivered, you know, they typically come in something like a tamper-proof blister pack so that, you know, you can only open it once, and it kind of communicates to you as the end user that you're the only person that's opened this up since it left the pharmacy. And I think there's going to be things like that that Uber and Lyft and other ride-hailing entities have to think about so that you get in those shared spaces again. Because the only way those drivers can really make money on the platform is if they have a ton of throughput. You know, they're doing dozens and dozens of rides a day, which is almost exactly the opposite of what you want to think about if you're getting in an Uber, you know, at the end of a shift when there's been 40 people sitting in it. So that's a big technical challenge and probably an equally big design challenge.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I think even in the best of times, these companies were so driven by growth and revenues, and the, you know, they needed to grow, that they didn't have any even basic, you know, checks and balances in place, like people with dodgy driving records. I mean, the enforcement is definitely an issue around these kind of companies. So, I mean, I think they may survive 2-3 months of the shutdown. I think the mistrust of shared spaces is going to be much harder for them to overcome, especially given the history of these companies. I definitely am, I'm on the negative side of this argument. You know, let's talk about, you know, what these drivers actually drive, which is the cars. Let's say, you know, the market is shut down for 3 to 5 months for new cars. What happens? To the auto industry, man, does it?
Yeah,
like, you know, again like I'm just like, it is mind-boggling to even imagine a world without vehicles, right? Like,
right. Or,
so what, even 3 months, like forget like a prolonged shutdown, 3 months.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are already very fragile in terms of, with the exception of maybe Volkswagen and Toyota, which have cops of money.
Yep.
The others are, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know this market as well as you do. I'd love to know what you think.
Yeah. Well, you know, although it's seasonal, the auto industry in the U.S. in terms of new vehicle sales, it's somewhere between like 1.3 and 1.5 million units per month on average. So you end up with like 17, like in a good year, you want to get to, for if you're a car maker, that the U.S. industry is selling 17 million units, new cars. And since there's going to be at least a month or two, maybe more, of no sales, you know, you're going to lose 3 million, 4 million, potentially 5 million units. The auto industry kind of, you know, it can get down to maybe around 12 million units of sales. But if the U.S. auto industry doesn't sell more than like 10.5 million units of new car sales, there's a lot of car companies that just, suppliers that just can't handle that and will go out of business, or will need significant bailouts, or will need to merge. So there's a breaking point if new vehicle sales don't kind of get going in a few months, or really in a few weeks. So there's a couple things there to unpack. One is, and I think the auto industry is interesting because there's always a counterpunch in the auto industry with direction of the industry of new car sales go down. What happens is actually people keep their cars longer. So service and maintenance businesses actually go up because you need more oil changes and more repairs and more tire changes and all that. Also, used vehicle sales tend to go up. So once you get out of COVID-19 lockdown, there's probably going to be some after effect like that that sits on the industry for a while until the industry maybe regains its sales numbers as it was. But the other thing about kind of the new car sales side of it is, you know, I think that people are going to respond differently to new car sales after this period. And that's kind of an open question that somewhat relates to your Uber questions earlier. Will one of the responses to this be that people go buy, you know, an extra vehicle? If they were a one-car family, do they move up to two-car? Do they stop using public transportation and bikes and shared pooled rides and things like that? It's possible that that could be one of the near-term implications of this. I hope it's not. You know, it doesn't help cities if people come out of COVID and go buy Chevy pickup trucks. It's actually not one of the answers, even though technically it might help Chevy. It's not one of the things that's going to be better for us. So a lot of these things kind of work in unison. I'm kind of interested in how the next couple of weeks fan out for the auto companies. And they're all trying to go online. So, you know, the online sales model in the U.S. car industry has been, you know, I would say a small minority of the better performing dealers have allowed you to do that. Obviously, Tesla, you can do that. But the far majority of U.S. dealerships, you can't actually open up a new car purchase online with them. And they're all scrambling right now to go and do that.
It'll be, you know, it's like I'm just looking at all the people I talk to, and the general perception is that, yeah, you don't, like, if you're like, unless you need something really, really badly, let's not worry about buying anything new right now. And that, unfortunately, is kind of, you know, canary in the coal mine for everybody, mm-hmm. not just auto industry. And like, it's definitely something to worry about, that behavior.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, you know, the car dealers are deemed, in most cases, they're deemed non-essential. So last week in the United States, there was, I think, 35% of retail dealerships were closed, probably 50% by the end of this week, and then something approaching 100% probably in the coming weeks or month. But the service operations of those dealerships are staying open because, you know, obviously you still have some people on the road. You have healthcare workers, you have people who need to get to essential services, and they need to get their cars fixed, they need to get tires changed and all that stuff. So there's that other component of, you know, the U.S. dealer model, which is still functioning, not at the same sort of level. So it definitely, I agree with you. Like, I think sales are going to be, new car sales are going to be incredibly difficult to get restarted at a level consistent with what we're used to. But of course, there's probably going to be, you know, financing and things that the auto companies try to do to get people to go buy a car again. Maybe the challenging part, though, to think about is, you know, the U.S. industry was headed into doing a lot more electric vehicles. And recently, the Trump administration rolled back a lot of the strict fuel economy standards, which were some of the impetus for auto companies delivering EVs to the market. And for the next 1 or 2 years, those product plans can't change because, you know, if you're 3 years into a designing and manufacturing an EV, you can't stop doing that, you know, 3 out of the 4 years into that project. So a lot of the cars that were kind of announced that were electric are going to still come out. But I think there's this kind of window after about 2022, 23, when some of the other programs that were in the pipeline, but not yet fully baked, those might get pushed out longer. So this could have an impact on things 3, 4 years from now too.
You mean in a positive way, that we'll have more EVs on the road?
I think we'll have less actually, but you know, because they're typically more expensive to develop, and other than the premium manufacturers, most of the car companies developing them haven't had a really great business model for them yet. So I think that the EVs that we would have expected in 2022, 23, those are probably going to get pushed back a little bit, and there's probably going to be fewer of them. Now, that could change if we get to November and there's a different administration and there's stricter fuel economy rules. And there's a lot of stuff that could change in the next few months that really relate to the product that you see on the road from auto companies as it relates to EVs.
It's funny because, you know the counter argument to all this is that if we have a lot more, let's say, new kind of delivery vehicles come into market, more kind of, you know, delivery mobility becomes a hot growth area, many of those things will be electric, not, you know, fossil fuel powered. So that would be an interesting, that would definitely would be an interesting, trend to develop. What's your take on your and my favorite point of argument, the micromobility landscape? Yeah. How does that change in your mind?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, so obviously the shared private networks like Bird and Lime are, you know, they're halting all their service. There's a few others that have kept it open. For example, there's a Spin, which is owned by Ford, is still open in 9 markets, I believe, because they've deemed those markets in the service to be essential. Mm-hmm. And there's some that are city-owned or city-sponsored, like City Bike, for example, which is still up and running because it's deemed essential. So there's kind of, if you look at the shared micromobility landscape, it's a little bit different across all the way you define those companies that are either running or not running. And in New York, the amount of bike trips over the bridges has gone up like 50%, and people are using City Bike like crazy because they're not using the subway as much or the bus. So I think one of the things that in the near term is there's probably a model for some of the large private operators who were typically doing shared rides to move into leasing and to retail. Because, you know, there's a common saying in micromobility, which is there's actually no heavy micromobility shared ride user. That typically what happens is after you've taken, 12 rides over a 2-week period or something, a lot of those people flip and they start looking at owning their own vehicle. Yeah, there's definitely counters to that, but there's a lot of people who get so exposed to micromobility in an urban area, they buy their own vehicle because they just know that it's, the payback is actually pretty short on it. And so the Bird and Lime question, I think, one is keeping the lights on, but two, how many of those customers would flip to a leasing model where you said, hey, the vehicle's yours for 30 days, it's only yours? I actually think that right now is a really interesting time for them to test that. And then on the sort of classic retail side, we are going to see more of the micromobility vehicles sold to people in these areas who just don't want to do any shared use stuff, and they just want to own a really nice small vehicle. So this all kind of relates to how much protected bike lane space you have in a city, and in New York and in San Francisco and other places, and Mexico City, for example, cities are putting down temporary micromobility or bike lanes, I should say, because they want people to get out and actually, get some air and have socially distant kind of activities. And I'm curious if some of these temporary bike lanes are going to flip to be permanent when the shutdown ends.
I wish I had a bike right now, to be honest. Like, I've been using the Lyft bike, and it's not really mm-hmm. the best experience. I would rather have my own bike. That would have been just so much better. Unfortunately, I don't. So
yeah.
I'm kind of unlucky like that. Otherwise, I would have waved you by going by your house.
And, yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you, Riley, for taking the time. And you take care of yourself. Hope you and your family stay good, stay well, and stay safe.
Thanks, Om. Really appreciate it.
Take care.